Welcome to AudioGal's March 2015 Narrators Forum. This year's forum features audio narrations in general, of all genres, and doesn't contain specific romance discussion topics. We're excited to have with us today six narrators who know their craft well and excel in performing audiobooks. Welcome to Luke Daniels, Tanya Eby, Patrick Lawler, Renee Rodman, Simon Vance, and Karen White.
Hi, guys.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Hi. It's great to be here.
We'll start today's forum with the question we most often receive from listeners. Simon, I'm directing this question to you first. Why aren't the majority of audiobooks performed by both a male and female narrator interacting with one another while each performs the appropriate gender roles? And as an extension to that question, what about the multicast productions? At what point does an audiobook narration become more of an audio theater type of production?
Well, good question. Interesting. I mean, so many aspects of this. My first response to it is, if you're talking about having one male, one female, is where do you stop? I mean, initially, the reason we have only one narrator doing one book is the work involved in doing more than one voice. The book has to really need more than one voice. And since narrators are good at creating the characters across the board, then they're not going to bring in. It's not really worth the extra investment in time and work and cost to split something up. I mean, what book, you have to ask yourself, lends itself to multi-voice? And I think the ones that do, I just did one with Exe Sands, where the chapters are from a female perspective or a male perspective, clearly. When they're not, when they're intermingled, it just becomes so complicated. And I think the listener will find that just too confusing, because you not only have the female voice and the male voice and that split up, you've got the commentary in between, the descriptive parts. Who does that? The work involved in making that listenable is incredible. You know, in my experience, I've done all sorts of different multi-voices. I think the most successful ones have been books that, as I say, delineate it clearly. I did Dracula, which is Letters of Jonathan Harker, or The Voice of Van Helsing. That's very clear. The Exe Sands Euphoria that I did with her, very clear separation of characters. Less clear, I did Dune, which was a mix of multi-voice and single narration. I did most of the narration, and then they devolved into what could be described, which you mentioned, an audio theater type production. They did both. To me, I don't see how it can work just deciding to split it between two unless it's delineated. And I've rambled on long enough. I think that, to me, is the short answer. It's just too complicated. Where do you stop without it going straight into audio theater, which, as you point out, is something else? I don't know if anybody else has a point of view here.
I do, actually. I think, kind of piggybacking on what you said, Simon, I agree. And I think also we're reading and narrating books. And generally, how is a book consumed if it's not told to you in a narration? You read it to yourself. That's one person interpreting it. So a lot of times I think we have the chance of leaving our fingerprint in a way of, if it's one person's take, instead of, like Simon said, you have two people, it starts to muddy the waters a little bit. Not for every book. Some books, you know, have a lot of great, you know, the one I did with Julia Whalen, Impossible Knife of Memory, you know, it's clearly broken up that one's the father talking and one's her regular narration. And that was so successful because she did 90% of the book. So that definitely was a plus in its factor. But I do think that generally we're translating or narrating as if we were reading this ourselves, you know, telling ourselves the story. And that would be us reading the book. So if it's one person, sometimes that kind of lends itself to a more complete package.
You're right that if a book is not clearly delineated from a point of view, it does make things very complicated. But if the author is well known enough that their sales can support a multi-read, personally, I love being able to be right in the booth with another actor. I know Patrick and I have worked on Suzanne Brockman's Troubleshooter series, and McLeod Andrews and I have done several of the Catherine Coulter and J.T. Ellison FBI series. And getting to sit right next to the narrator, you know, the partner, your partner right in the same booth, getting to see each other. I think those are some of the best times I've ever had narrating a book. And Patrick's laughing because sometimes we can't get through a sentence because, you know, the other is so funny. Usually Patrick's the funny one. And I have a lot of fun with, enjoy taking out the he said, she saids with the author approval, especially when it reads back and forth within the script. It just makes it a little bit more of a movie for the mind. But not every book can support that financially because you're paying extra production cost, extra narrator cost, et cetera. But I just think it's really great that the audience for audiobooks has a lot of choices, whether it's a multicast read or a duo or a single.
I would say that that definitely goes into the audio theater. When you start taking out the he said and she said, when you edit the book, it changes the book fundamentally, I think, and that becomes a theater production. I mean, none of the multi-voices I've done have I ever been in the studio with anybody else. They've always been separated. Even Dune, I was not working with anybody else. So I record my part and it's put together. So, you know, it's fine if you're in the studio with somebody else, but I think once you get more than one person in the studio, it becomes something other than a straightforward audiobook narration.
This is Tanya. Can I jump in real quick?
Please.
I actually did one that was not audio theater with Phil Giganti, where we left in all of the tags, he said, she said, and he narrated all of the male characters and I narrated all of the female characters. And it sounds like it would be a great idea, but it actually was really awkward. And there were all these micro pauses as we decided who did what and in changing characters. And I think there's something really primal about one person telling you a story, which
That's
I think works really.
Done. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah. This is Patrick. If I can jump in here as well and get back to it. If you're doing it for a purpose, for a point, like, Renee mentioned the Suzanne Brockman Troubleshooters series, where she specifically writes each chapter in a point of view from a specific character. And then that character is responsible for telling the story and picking up the thread of the story. I think then it can be very effective. And I think it can be very, I think it can enhance the experience for the listener. I think when you start, like Simon said, when you start divvying it up within, it becomes something else, and it isn't a storytelling session. You're no longer a storyteller. You're an actor playing a part, and I think that's a completely different experience. And personally, I find it very confusing as a listener when all of a sudden there are multiple voices, and the he saids and she saids are still there, and I it takes me a little while for my mind to kind of wrap around that as a listener. So my preference, for what it's worth, is one person telling the story for the length of time that they're telling it, and then another person maybe taking that over and saying it from a different point of view. I think that can be quite fun and quite moving.
This is Karen. Can I jump in?
Oh, please.
There was actually tonight, I don't know if anyone else heard it, but on NPR's All Things Considered, a story about audiobooks and about how some writers are actually starting to write audio theater specifically to be published as an audiobook. And I think it's great that, like someone else said, we're giving listeners more and more types of listening experiences. One of the ones they had as an example had sound effects and voices talking over each other. And, you know, it sounded to me like a radio play. But I think that we do also want to let listeners know that listening, like Patrick was just saying, listening to a book, it's a very intimate experience, just like reading is an intimate experience. The author wrote it by themselves, usually for one person to read by themselves, usually. And I think we just hopefully seamlessly step in between there and become the conduit for people who can't read or for people who just want to be told the story. And from my point of view, having done one-woman shows in the theater before I started this, it's been really exciting over my time of working on audiobooks for it to go from, when I started, the style was really more reading someone a story with not a lot of actual acting out of scenes or emotional content going on. But because of listener preferences, I know I have sort of upped my game. And now I feel like I am doing a one-person show. I'm fully invested in each character and their intention and their emotional journey. And I think it's, to me, it's the joy of the work is to, I go on that journey that the author has written and hopefully take the listener with me on that journey. But it's still, when I'm talking into my mic, I'm always picturing that I'm talking to one person, that I'm sharing this with one person. And I hope that even though listeners have all kinds of choices and they seem to be expanding more and more, that we can seduce those who want a full cast to appreciate one person sort of living the story in their ear with them.
I see a need here to educate the audio listener on just what they need to expect in an audiobook, that it is a different type of entertainment altogether. We hear all these wishes. Oh, I wish, you know, all the men would be performed this way and the women this way. And I wish, you know, we could see all of these characters. And I myself have done that. And it's like you said, it's very jarring to me. I can't stay in the story because I'm constantly having to adapt my mind to the different voices. And there are no dialogue tags anymore. And therefore, I'm not understanding everything that's going on. But how do we educate the audio listener on this? I mean, it is something we try to do.
I hate the idea that we'd have to educate the listener. I think they just, I guess it's true that perhaps that's needed if they're demanding a certain thing, but that's not what audiobooks are. They're looking for something else. And it may be people coming from watching TV, going to the movies, going to the theater, whereas multiple people, this is sitting around the campfire, reading somebody telling you a story. That's what it is. And how much dramatization you put into it is up to the actor who's performing the book. But I think it's, to me, it's a different kettle of fish. Once you get beyond, you have the single narrator, or if you have a multiple narrator situation where the chapters are different, the perspectives are different, somebody's writing letters to somebody else back and forth, when you can really delineate it, anything beyond that does become audio theater. And the reason, ultimately, the two reasons I say, which is sort of repeating myself in a way, but the two reasons, one is the cost in terms of time and money, and the other is that this is storytelling. We are sitting around the campfire reading you a story. And I think that's, if that counts as an education, then yes, educate them.
Okay. This is Tanya. I also think that romance readers have an expectation or a hope that you'll have, like, if you have a love scene, you want to hear the male and the female. So there's that awkward expectation that you're hearing one person who's sort of like making love to themselves, which is awkward. But if it's performed really well, that falls away and you just hear the characters.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. It's, if anything, I agree with Simon about an education sounds a bit severe, but more about an awareness of what this entails, of that if you give someone time, I mean, it's up to their personal preference as to what type they like, what appeals to them. But if you give that narrator the time it takes, and it usually takes, even for me, you know, a few minutes to get into someone else's voice, it takes a little while to kind of break down those barriers. And if you give it some time, you might find yourself after a chapter or two going, oh, I really, you know, I'm in it with this person. We've gone along together, and it becomes a much more intimate experience. The very first 5 minutes are hard in anything. You have to give it time.
I think also, this is Karen, I've read some blog posts where people are commenting about this, what the difficulties that new listeners have. And I think it's important to acknowledge that we're a really visual society. We've gone from, in Shakespeare's time, when they talked about going to hear a play, now we see everything. We're looking at everything. We're taking everything in visually. And I think we have to exercise that connection from our ears to our brains, to our imaginations. And it may take some listeners, whether they're listening to a multicast production or not, time to get used to taking in all the information through their ears.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to our next discussion topic. What are the methods you use to differentiate your characters? Are there times when you feel it is more appropriate to read a book without vocally distinguishing one character from another? And accents. When does a narrator choose to perform an accent? Do audiobook publishers prefer the use of accents, or is that more of a narrator's personal choice? Renee, I'm calling on you this time.
No pressure. I would say to the first part of your question, you know, I'm sure if you talk to 50 different narrators, you'll hear 50 different stories of how they create and differentiate their characters. So I can only speak personally that when I'm prepping a book, I write down every single description there is for that character. What they drink, what job they do, how they speak, what color hair they have, how they dress, because I think that for me, I'm very visual. So I create a visual character in my head, and then it just seems that the voice follows naturally. And I actually can't say that that was always the way when I very first started in audiobooks, but I think it's that way now. But I also use my real life when I'm out in the world and I see somebody who is just such a delicious character that I think I am going to find some character in a book that's just going to be perfect for. Mm-hmm. I was in Palm Beach last week and there was a hostess at a restaurant, and I couldn't take my eyes off of her or stop listening to her because of the way she dealt with the phone and us. And I turned to John and I just said, someday this woman will be in a book. So that's the way I differentiate my characters. And coming from the voiceover background, it was always very strong, strongly encouraged that in cartoons and video games, you know, you had to be very specific with your characterization. So I didn't really know any better when I came to audiobook. So I do my very best to make every character sound different if the book is appropriate. I think that in some books, particularly nonfiction, and certain times authors will say, I really just want you to tell the story. I don't want you to do much character differentiation. Well, you know, I'll do my best to honor that. In terms of accents, I think that the publishers expect the narrator to support an accent if it's mentioned in the book. I think they would be very disappointed, and you might not get a job with them again if you didn't. I think, you know, if it says they're Irish, why then you better be able to perform an Irish accent for a specific character. But I think one of the things that's fun as a narrator is if there are little side characters that are not necessarily called out to what they might be, but you're in a certain locale, et cetera, that you can add accents to help with those smaller characterizations. And, you know, you don't always, for me anyway, I'm not speaking for everybody on the panel, but I can tell you that the accent portion of this has been a sink or swim for me. You know, you figure out how to do it when you have to do it, and you just work really hard and cross your fingers because, you know, you're sort of by your lonesome most of the time in the booth, and the engineer is not always going to say, yeah, you're really hitting that one right on. So it's a lot. I think that's been the most work for me. You know, I came into audiobooks having one or two, maybe three accents that I was felt good about. And then before I knew it, I was being called in to do things that I was really uncomfortable with. And so you just have to show up and
like you're sitting in the booth with me. Is that what you're?
Oh, yeah. Well, you're so good at them, Patrick. You know, I can't imagine what all I learned from Patrick, both good and bad. Okay. So I think that's my response to that.
Yeah, I just Simon here, and it's interesting when presented with a book. A lot of the characters are delineated in the sense that they have, it's dictated the accents and so on. But the joy is, as Renee mentioned, all those other minor characters who don't. And I do think it's important to differentiate. I don't think it becomes a bit bland. I remember right at the beginning of my narrating career, which goes back over 30 years, for the recording books for the blind in London. And we always had a tea break, and sitting in a little group with all these actors from the West End or other broadcasters, as I was at the time. And there was one fellow there, one of the old hands, who was absolutely adamant that you didn't put any characterization in. I never got to listen to any of his books, but he came from that side. And actually, I think he was in the majority then. This is in the UK in the 80s. And I was sort of unique in that I couldn't not do it because I was sort of born performer or something like that. I mean, I was given a tape recorder in the 60s and I played with silly voices and I never stopped.
Me too. This is Renee. Me too, Simon. That's great. My parents would be like, "You've been in the bathroom too long. What are you doing?" I have my tape recorder. The acoustics are great in here.
Oh, see what it is. See what it takes to become an audiobook narrator. We all have those stories now these days that we cannot not do the voices. And I, you know, in terms of the description, yes, you make the notes on what is said, and that's one of the reasons I absolutely adored reading Charles Dickens. Unfortunately, I've pretty much done all his books, so I don't have them unless I reread them again. But he always, his characters' names usually describe them very well, but also before anybody spoke, they usually had a paragraph of he was a large, round fellow with chubby cheeks or something about their attitude, which lent themselves to giving them a character voice. But that's not always the case. And in terms of how much character you give to a voice, that depends a lot on the type of book it is. And the sort of the age range of the people in the book and so on and so forth. So with Dickens or Trollope, a lot of the characters can be quite broad, but a contemporary novel, perhaps contemporary romance novel, you're not going to be able to do that without it sticking out and jarring. And that's what you don't want to do. You don't want to get in the way of the story.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. This is Karen. For me, each book is like a whole new world, and deciding how theatrical to make the characterizations, what accents to use, it's really dictated by what the author has set out. And as Renee said, often, most of the time in a nonfiction book, you're not going to do character voices and accents. But this summer, I recorded a book about four women who were in the Civil War, all strong actors that did crazy things during the war. And the book was full of quotes from their diaries and letters, and they just called out to have their home accents to me. And so I did it that way, and it was successful. But not every nonfiction book or every book sort of demands the characterization that one did.
It's whatever helps the book, I think. And with a nonfiction book, quite often you don't need to do that because every quote will be credited. But, you know, if it's not credited immediately and it's credited right at the end, sometimes you need to get the rhythm of the person who is speaking. You know, if it's Churchill being quoted or Roosevelt or something like that, you know, it's a case-by-case instance, and you need to take on board what does the listener need here.
Yeah, even if it's just like an essence or something that helps you distinguish a male quote versus a female quote, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I will say, Simon, you were talking about how much fun it is to add characterizations and accents to the smaller characters in which it's, you know, there's very little told about. And, you know, we may talk about this later, but when you don't know a book is a part of a series and you do that in the beginning, and then the author comes book three and describes that character that you gave a hardcore Southern accent to, that they're from Ireland,
Yeah.
Well, you know that there, we get into a little trouble there. So yeah. Now I'm so nervous. I'm always asking, is there any chance this book is a series? You know.
Yeah, I think it's important if you have those minor characters not to give them like I'm going to give this guy an accent from the Ozarks or something. You know, not something very specific like that, but in terms of pitch or whatever,
right.
Or characterization in terms of not characterization in terms of the accent as much as just the personality,
right? Right.
Which is another part of it. You know, I mean, I go back to I think it was Anthony Trollope, where the fellow's sitting around the table with seven daughters in this one family, and they all have something to say. You know, you got to pitch them differently because they're interrupting each other, but you've got to remember who was who.
Right.
So that you know, and usually in the simplest sense, and I can't remember this is how I did it, but you take the eldest to the youngest, you know, and the youngest, and you sort of do that in a very sort of generic way, in a sense, that they're all from the same family, but there's the younger one's going to have more spirit, the older one's probably going to be more conservative. That's right. Just an example of possibly how to do that, but yeah.
I think that's an important point, though, the technicality of the fact that you're telling the author's story and you're also keeping in mind you have a listener. So it's about highlighting the character that the author presents, but also how do you tell the story of the scene the best? So if there's, you know, some roadside cafe with a waitress, what's the tone of the scene will reflect on how you voice that waitress, even if the author doesn't specifically say she's a lonesome, you know, single mom waitress. But depending on what's going on around her, you might want to add some flavor that kind of supports what's already happening atmospheric-wise for the scene.
Yeah, this is I think why it's so important that people coming into the business want to be audiobook narrators must. It really helps to have an actor's background because you have all, you know, 1,000 characters inside you. You have an understanding of the text of the story that's being told. You can look behind and you can do that authentically. You're not just picking an accent out of your hat or an attitude out of your hat. You're doing it from the clues that are in the text. Mm-mm.
Have you also noticed that accents have changed, too? I'm noticing that younger people across the country, it seems to be getting lighter.
There is. There's more of that diversity kind of spreading out. Things are becoming, they're not as hard-edged anymore.
Right. And so, like, when I'm making choices, unless a writer says it's a thick accent, I try to just give a flavor of it because things are changing, which I find very interesting.
And rhythm does a lot, too. How you handle the rhythm of that person's speech pattern can denote a lot of character without having to study, okay, I'm going to, you know, do this kind of R shading for every R, and I'm going to make sure all the A's turn to I's, or, you know, any sort of practice that way that you can work with their personal rhythm and bring out that kind of individual characteristics that way.
I think a lot of it gets back to what Simon had said earlier about storytelling, like sitting around a campfire, telling a story. And when you do that, you naturally go to voices a little bit, but when needed. And I think that's, I think a lot of what we're going to say in this call this evening, or in this forum, is going to get back to that storytelling thing. Sometimes you need the witch to sound like a witch. And sometimes you need the hero to sound heroic or whatever it is. But sometimes you don't. Sometimes in the story, you just need to get on with it and say what's happening. And I think each book has its own rhythm as far as that's concerned. And, you know, just keeping the story flowing is more important, really, than getting every single R or keeping the accent absolutely pure. I think getting the essence and moving the story forward is what the most important thing is.
And a lot of times, if you're playing the actual intention of what the person's trying to get from the other person in the scene, and it'll start to come out on its own just through that being kind of trained actors or people that have done this before, you start to kind of take on those qualities just by the fact that you're trying to get something from the other guy or girl or alien or whatever.
Y'all said so much more than I even thought would be said. So I really learned a lot in not that little session right there. Let's talk about series. Luke, I'm directing this your way. Series seem to be everywhere these days, but I think it must be a challenge to the narrator. This was mentioned briefly just now, but how do you prepare for and continue working on a series? What are the special demands that a series requires?
Well, I think that longevity is a big part of it. So you're going in most of the time, you know, when you read the script, you're like, okay, he's setting me up for something. And you're right. The frequency of series seems to be more and more, everybody's kind of doing it, so to speak. And so you can kind of assume if it's halfway decent, this person might pump out two or three more. And so you want to plan for that longevity, like I think was mentioned before about not going too wild for some of the minor characters that then may come and have their own book too down the road, and you're stuck with voicing everybody like this the whole book. Really screwed myself with that. But you definitely have to, you also have to tell the book that you're in. I think that's as important as the fact that you're maintaining that series. And I think that authors change things sometimes from book to book. Nothing big, obviously, because they're building a world. Generally, that's part of it too. And as an actor, that's even more fun to play, because when you get to do a series, you get to develop these characters over sometimes years. And so they become very near and dear to you. It'd be like as if you were on a TV show for 3-4 seasons. You start to really kind of find different levels. I did a Ed McBain series, Matthew Hope, and he's like a lawyer in, you know, seedy Florida. And by the end of like 6 of those books, I loved that guy. And I mean, it helped that Ed McBain just wrote such great characters, and, you know, it had such a great milieu to it. But you really get to kind of go through all of these things. I mean, by the time you're done with 7 books, and if it's something like the Iron Druid series, you've killed gods and you've lost friends and you've had to fight people and you've ran away and you've cried and you've gone through all those things, and it becomes a part of you in a way. And it's an honor to get to do something like that, to carry something for that long of a period of time. But I mean, I just had an experience that was for that same series where there's the dog character who's been very popular, but he has changed over time, and I've changed over time. So if I listen to something like the first book I did for that series, which was very early in my career, my voice is different. It's been 5-6 years. Know. So my voice changes. I mean, partly I'm still going through my special time. It has changed, and my narration style has changed just from experientially and from just doing it and learning what I like and how I like to present the story and what I want to do. So there's a difference there, but that doesn't bother me. And for instance, this character it's been, you know, called out that he's kind of different. He's got the same qualities, but he's shifted. And it was a conscious choice partly on my part, because I had played him one way that I really liked as his basic element, right? And then after the second book, I didn't leave myself enough room to move with him, because he was a major player in 6-7 books. I needed to give him greater range in his voice so that I could play the greater range that would be called upon over 6, 7, 8, 9 books. So I opened up, in my mind at least, this is my actor's justification hat, I opened up my range with him while retaining the same basic intention, the same basic personality, the same basic character, but broadening it and developing it. So yeah, you could listen to something in the first book and then listen to it in the third and go, hey, that's subtly different. But in a way, it's a choice. And I think you have to remain true to everything you set before, if for no other reason than they'll, you know, Molotov cocktail you online if you change things. there is a way that you can be true to the individual book and bring out the story. That story is the most important, and then the overall story is ultimately what you're serving as well.
This is Karen, and having done several series where you stay in the same sort of town or working environment, and a different hero and heroine come to the fore in each book, while the other people are still sort of around and coming into the scenes, my actor justification is that the hero and the heroine, while again I try to sort of stay faithful to their basic rhythm maybe a roughness to the voice or a squeakiness to a female voice, but when they're going through their love story, they're going to go through a huge range of emotions that they don't when they're a secondary character. So I allow them to have a much wider range in their voices as well as in their experience, because it makes sense. You know, when I'm talking to my kids, I use a different voice than I'm yelling at my husband or when I'm talking to a customer service person online. You know, we have a lot of range in our voices. I think it's just important to make it recognizable.
Luke, this is Renee. I have a question for you. When you started this series, did you know it was going to be a series? And if so, or if you didn't know, how did that make a difference or not?
I knew it would be a series, yeah. I believe this was early enough on that I didn't know what the hell I was doing anyway. So I was definitely flying by the seat of my pants. It was one of my first series. I remember that. I'd had a... So I think I knew, but I also... I've always been fairly obstinate in that what I'm doing in the moment of the book is what I'm going with. And so if I'm doing that first book, it is about what's happening in the moment of that first book. And I may have grand designs and plans ahead of time of I'm going to pitch this guy here and I'm going to want this guy to have this. And he says that this person speaks in some made up accent that I've got to, you know, so all that's going on. But in the moment, it's what happens in the actual live performance, which is being caught on tape. So it's this delicate balance between that. So I'm way off topic, but Renee, I think that first one, I was really just kind of exploring and finding how does it affect me? And then the next one, it's like, okay, so I did that for this first one. Is that really going to work now in the next one? Yeah, that definitely works. Or you know what? Now he's Russian, according to the author. So we're going to have to make him Russian because this book he is, even though the last book he didn't say what he was and I made him Southern. So, and that's happened. I did that for another series.
Right.
But it just is what it is. You serve the book that you're in. And if they're anything like me, which they're not, because they do remember, I don't remember. You know what I mean? Like, I remember the idea or the performance, but, you know, a little bit of variation. You've got a little bit of room to tell the story in a way that's the most beneficial to what's happening in that moment.
Yeah.
This is Tanya.
Go ahead, Tanya.
Oh, sorry. This is a little bit different, but I do the Fool's Gold series by Susan Mallory. And each story is its own piece, although it takes place in the same town. And one thing that's been really fun for me is she's really stretched me as an actor because I try not to duplicate the voices. I'm limited in some ways, but it's really pushed me to try to make each book with their two main characters different from the previous books, but give the characters something new and interesting. So she's helped.
Did something, are you still here, Tanya?
We missed something.
Yeah, I did see the last thing.
Put the glass down, Tanya.
Sorry. It's down. It's down. I drank before coming on. I don't know. I said she's just, her books have helped me become a better actor in trying new voices and finding, Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that one thing that the listener sees with the series, whenever I listen to one book a year in a series, I do not remember if the vocalizations are the same from book to book. But you have so many listeners that go back and listen to the series from the beginning through. And I think that's when the complaints arise, you know, because they are actually have a week break in between a book. Well, you all have had a year, and you've built it for absolutely years. So
yeah, they're into this binge listening now,
right?
Thanks to
they
Netflix.
They really are.
I mean, from my experience, there's a sort of I'm my own worst enemy when it comes to series. There's what I should do, and there's what I do, and a lot of narrators will keep voice files for the characters that appear. I know. I mean, I'm sure a lot of that is exactly what you should do. I don't, but that's my own fault. So what I do when I get a book that's sort of 2 years later, I get the next one, I go back and I will listen to the book, even if I have to pay for it for myself and download it from Audible. You know, and even when it's not 2 years, when it's only a year or something, I remember doing that with the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, those three, the trilogy. And now I've just been asked to do the fourth one, which is the one not written by Stieg Larsson, by somebody else. And that'll be later on. And I know I'm going to have to go back and listen. I know roughly who these people are. I know roughly what sort of voice I gave them. But I will absorb not only, while I'm doing that, I will absorb not only their voices, but I'll get the sense of the book again, you know, the rhythms and the speed and the pacing and the kind of where it's at and so on. So that sort of benefits me in that sense. But yes, ideally, I should do what all good narrators do.
Simon,
all you guys is keep the files.
What,
yes.
What many
this is
good
Renee.
Narrators do.
Oh. Yes.
Well, actually, though, you know, back when I first began, I think one of my first five books was a beginning of a series, and I didn't know how to even spell series, you know, when I was, and I didn't know, well, I don't know that anyone knew that A, it would be going on to a series, and B, how long it would last. So, you know, that very first book, if, you know, takes place in Georgia. Well, a lot of people had Georgian accents or did, you know, that sort of thing, or if it gave a description and you kind of grabbed onto those little clues. And when the next came around, the next one came around, and there was a few characters that were repeated, you know, you think, okay, I can do this. And I'd go back and I listened to parts of the book because I was working on a publisher's, a specific publisher's recording. Help me out.
Software.
Thank you. Software that didn't allow me, I didn't have a way to pull characters, but I don't think I would have known to do that in the first two or three books. Well, 9 years later, I can tell you that for me, series are the most work that I do in all of my prepping, because I know that Catherine Kellergren, like from the beginning when she was doing Bloody Jack, she started pulling characters right away, which was brilliant. And I wished I had thought of those things way back when. But now I've come up with a new system in which, because it became, like Simon said, I was going back to search for each character, find it. So, and sometimes it would be in the middle of recording because it just seemed to take less time than, or you'd forget by the time it was 8 hours into the 13 or 15 hour book. And so now I've become a little more savvy after a lot of heartache in it all. And I hire somebody to help. They go through the script as well. And I have now lists and pages of books that are, you know, recurring series. And I've got every character with all their descriptions written down and the author's descriptive words about them.
Yeah, good and, for you. See, after 30 years, wow. I'm still not doing it.
Well, you know, I'm going to use Patrick as an example for series, because we just saw him do something, and we're kind of, there's a very popular series that has many entries. I don't know. Is Troubleshooters up to 17, Patrick? Do you recall?
I think that's it. Yeah, I think it stopped at book 17.
And he started at book 6. So he's been narrating books 6 to 17 for years. And then they come back in because books 1 through 5, I will say this, they were not narrated well. And they all had different narrators. And so we were complaining, going, you know, we can't, this narrator just does not get the sense. And they were made many, many years ago. And we know narration has changed. Patrick had to come back and start books 1 through 5. This last year, and they had running characters that he had performed in 6. How did you do that?
A lot of alcohol. It was a real eye-opening experience to take these people that had already had their story arcs way before I ever got there. And I did not, when I picked it up, with book, I think it was book 6, book 7, whatever it was.
7, yes. Okay.
I did not know that I was going to continue on. I thought it was kind of a one-off thing. So, you know, I did what everybody's been talking about and gave wild accents to the small characters and things like that. And then if somebody, like I had one character that showed up just to get shot in an elevator and he had about 3 lines. So I figured, no big deal. And I think I made him something like this or whatever. And then in one of the earlier books, he was a major character who had a major storyline, who was described as, you know, being constantly on coffee and wanting nothing more than to be around his computers all day. So it gives me a totally different take on the character. So basically you fudge, you know, you kind of go, all right, well... maybe when he's not, you know, at his best, he sounds like this.
Yeah.
And you kind of morph it and you do what you can do. But it really is kind of a fun exercise in going back and doing things. And it also helps a lot. I had the opportunity to work very closely with the author, and it helped a lot that she was able to say, okay, well, you know, these characters had this backstory. So I did have a little bit going into the later books when I knew I was going to be working a lot on that. But yeah, it's very interesting. And I have to say on that, I'm very happy that I got to do that, because there's a sense of completion now going back and getting to have done the full set from the series. There's something very, very fun about being able to say, I've completed this entire arc.
Well, and you know, it is one, if you talk about a series that has binge listening, that is one. And I
yes,
mean,
it is.
They are comparing. Yes. Patrick, I am going to lead directly, because you have the lead on the next question and you just introduced it.
Oh.
Relationships with authors.
Oh.
This is the next discussion topic. How do you feel about working with the author? I'm aware at one time interaction between the narrator and author was discouraged, yet I hear that this type of thing is encouraged now. Do you find benefit from this, and have any of you made joint appearances with an author? I know that Patrick, Renee, and Karen have all recorded talks here at Audio Gals with the author of a series they perform. So Patrick, why don't you continue on with that?
Okay, well, yeah, that's very good. First of all, I think any chance you get to have contact with and form a relationship with the author, especially on series, but in general, I think it's very important, because when you get right down to it, they're the creator of this work. They're the person that actually created the material that you're taking and moving to the next level. So I think if you have the opportunity to pick their brain and say, well, what were you thinking here? Or what would you like to see happen here? Or where does this go? Or even how do you say this person's name? I think that's vital information. And, you know, coming from a theater background like I do, preparation involves gathering as much information as you can get. And I mean, geez, if I had William Shakespeare sitting there saying, okay, well, you know, I was really kind of thinking that the ghost was really in Hamlet's mind or something like that. Yeah, I'd want to know that. You know, I'd want to know everything that person could tell me. And 9 times out of 10, I find that the authors are very helpful and very willing to do whatever they can do to help make my job easier. With the series, like I was saying, the series you're talking about, wonderful author Suzanne Brockman, is very, very generous with her time and her knowledge on these characters, and she's given me quite a bit to go on. And some authors would rather not be involved, but for the most part, the ones I've contacted were almost thrilled that their books were being made into audiobooks, and they would go out of their way to be helpful. I understand that it was at one time kind of frowned upon by some publishers, and I think that was more to...
Can I interrupt there a moment?
Yes,
Patrick?
Please,
I just want to, because I made a note of that, because the author contact discouraged question is it was really the publishers, and it was more in the earlier days I should say, of audiobooks, when a lot of authors it was that of several occasions when authors got upset because they wanted to narrate their own books, and they suddenly get a call from a narrator, and what the publishers were trying to do is get in between the narrator and the author to make the introduction. Once the introduction is made, I don't think the publisher has an issue, but if an author has no idea what's happened to his book and he gets a call from an actor out of the blue saying, I'm narrating your book, and I just want, you're narrating my book? I knew nothing about this. And it caused eruptions along the way. So I think it's not, if you're working for a big publisher, they like to make the introduction. The fact that you contact the author for research purposes, I think that's fantastic. And I think publishers agree with that. I just want to get in there and say that's what I understand the situation was, that there were occasions when there were problems because the author didn't know what was happening to their book, and they get surprised by this shot out of left field. Yeah.
Yeah, that would totally make sense. And I've pretty much run my thought process on that. So if anybody else has anything to say, please jump in.
You also have an opportunity nowadays with Twitter, I find, because a lot of writers are on Twitter. It's kind of a writer's medium in a way, even though it's such short sentences. But it there's more contact I'm finding now that way. And it kind of works in a cross-promotional aspect. And I think fans kind of like to see that kind of interaction between the author and the narrator. And it's not for everybody or every author, but I have found that that's been beneficial in a way that it gives just a kind of peek behind the curtain, which I think a lot of people like, or the glass door, as it were. But I think that it's kind of important to have that if they offer it. I mean, ultimately you are the one doing the book, so they're giving you things, but you know, you're the one in the booth speaking the words. So you're kind of the last stop, but any information you can have ahead of time, especially if it's from the horse's mouth, then I think it's valuable information for a narrator.
Yeah, I have a lot more contact with authors now than I used to. I think part of the reason for that is I used to do more of the dead authors like Charles Dickens and Anthony Trollope.
I was going to say, if you have contact from Charles Dickens, we need
the
to
Ouija
talk.
Board. Yeah, like, the Ouija board. What did you mean by that? But nowadays, I mean, I love it. I haven't ever done any sort of live interviews or those author teas and stuff that they do. But I do have back and forth. And one particular author, Brent Weeks, I've done his last couple of his fantasy novels, and you know, we collaborated, and I recorded all the pronunciations, and he put them up on his website because he's you know, created this world with all these different names and so on, and you know, I helped him present that on his website. So you know, anything like that. And again, I did do a written interview with another author, Bruce Holsinger, with on salon.com. His book, A Burnable Book, and that was printed on salon.com. And so I think there's a lot more interaction now, and it's almost expected in a way that it wasn't, that there was a sort of separation, because I don't think authors really understood audiobooks. Now, of course, they do, and they expect it to be a part of it, and they like to be involved in how it's presented. And I think they understand that they're not always the best narrators themselves.
But have you ever had them deliberately mess with you in the text where they'll write something in? You're like, I know that you're doing that because you know I have to now say it. Where they'll like just do a little tip of the hat.
Yes.
On the one hand, you're thrilled because you're like, oh my God, that's like put in there because he knows it fucks with me. But excuse me. But on the other hand, you're like, you jerk. You jerk.
I'm going to just jump back in, Patrick. And, as far as cross promoting goes, it's fantastic for me, and it's just like an ego thing. And you don't even really need to put this, but for the troubleshooters for Suzanne's site, Brockman's site, I refer to it as my Paramus Mall, which I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Soap Dish. There's a wonderful scene where Sally Field is this aging. Older soap star.
Beautiful, talented.
Beautiful, talented woman of a certain age.
Lies, yes.
Oh, but she would get a little depressed and a little down on herself, and her assistant, the lovely and talented Whoopi Goldberg, would take her to the Paramus Mall and just kind of step about 5 feet away, turn around and go, oh my God, isn't that so-and-so? And everybody would flock to her, and she'd get to sign autographs for hours at a time and make her feel better. And I'll go on Suzanne's site and I'll see people say lovely things about the series. And it does whenever I'm feeling, you know, a little bit, and this is pretty horrible too, but whenever I'm feeling a little bit kind of down on myself, I'll go over there and just kind of look up troubleshooters and just see them say nice things about it. Not necessarily even about me, just about the series. And it just kind of makes me feel better. Yeah. But so I guess that's one benefit of cross promoting.
I think it's one of, I just did a Twitter thing this afternoon while I was in the car this afternoon driving down I-5. And my wife was driving, I should say. I wasn't looking at my phone, but this is one from a woman at CNN. So this is a tweet. This is how big a geek I am. Sometimes I'll buy an audiobook just because Sim Van has narrated it. And I put in there, that's not unusual. that's quite normal. I said, that's quite normal. And it's that sort of that self-promotion thing. So you're fine doing that, going to your mall. And I think that's a part of what's expected of us. And if we can do that with the authors, of course, absolutely is paramount, because you've got a double whammy. No, that's great. Mm-hmm.
This is Renee. I think that you know, I think authors are finding that audiobook sales are more and more important, because not only do they benefit from audiobook sales, but they also sell more of the hard copy or paperback. And we're finding that more and more authors are interested in pre-promotion of audiobooks coming out, because now they're often tied to the release of the print edition. And it's kind of fun working with them on different ideas, whether they write interviews for their characters and they're asking their own characters questions, or they're writing little synopsis with their characters before the book's ever released, or they're giving little snippets of the audio on their sites beforehand. So it's really exciting to see how much authors have embraced audiobooks, and that just wasn't the case a few years ago. And that makes it even more fun for me anyway.
If I may, then, something else that just occurred to me is I have had a conversation with an author where she's told me that the cross promotion also works in a way that people will listen to us as narrators, and they'll know us by our work, and we bring an audience with us when we narrate, and that helps them, and then they also have their audience that then will hear us, and then they bring them to the table. So it kind of cross populates our listener base too, and it helps both of us to build that.
I know that's one reason whenever we're asked for, you know, we're often asked by an author, can you recommend a narrator to us? You know, and that's a very broad base there to give one name. But we do encourage them that a well-known narrator will bring an audience with them. You know, I listen to certain books that I wouldn't read in print because I have one of my narrators I absolutely trust, my trusted narrator, doing the performing. All right, let's go on to question 5. This is Tanya. I'm directing this to you.
Okay.
Now, this is getting a little bit into more what listeners hear that they're not happy with. But we're exploring what in the world is happening in some of these situations. We're going to talk about what listeners assume are poor production issues. Or let's be honest, possibly we're wondering if the narrator is responsible for these blunders.
Okay.
Yes.
It's those times that we repeatedly hear the narrator take a breath, or possibly there's an annoying click in the back, or it's the present of that hum in the background, or the fuzzy background noise, or it's the obvious edits. I know y'all have another word for it. Repeating sentences or words are left out altogether, or it's a clear change in background noise or volume level when a correction is made. So my question, what goes into assuring a crystal clear listen? Do narrators make a conscious effort to avoid audible breathing, or are there techniques to minimize this effect? And is there advice you can offer to other narrators to avoid this type of problem?
Okay. That's a big question. Did I get that because of all my burping?
You said you liked it.
I do like it. Because I think there's actually a couple of things going on here that need to be separated. There are a lot of narrator issues, which we will all take responsibility and apologize for. Mm-hmm. But there's also engineering and technological things happening. So if you hear a buzzing, that's an engineering issue. And that really shouldn't be in top companies' recordings. I've heard it a lot in like some smaller companies and some new publishing platforms. And that's concerning because that's really distracting. When I set up my own studio, I actually had an engineer. I paid an engineer to come in and format everything for me so that there wouldn't be any of those issues. And then there's ambient noise, like a door closing, that you can't, you try to leave out of the recording. Narrator issues, there's all these boards where we're aware of breathing and mouth noises, and we try to do our best. There's all these tricks of like drinking lemon water, eating potato chips, green apples. It just goes on and on and on. So if there's something that's really annoying, we do like a punch edit where you're recording, and when you screw up or there's a noise or a huge breath, you stop and you go back and you pick up from the last line and then you move forward. So hopefully that catches a lot of things. But in terms of breathing, there was this big Facebook feed about breathing and controlling that. It's hard because we're human and we're storytellers and we have to breathe. So I don't know. Some of it's distracting, but some of it's also that intimate storytelling. Like, I listen to audiobooks all the time, and I don't mind hearing that the narrator is human and breathes. But I can see how the big ones would be distracting, and some of that should be pulled out in the editing process. So there's a few things that are going on that can be distracting, and it's unfortunate because it pulls you out of the story when you're focused on those issues, and you shouldn't. That's a shame when that happens.
Yeah, I think this, Simon here, this is a huge issue. We could spend hours talking about it. You mentioned the Facebook post, and I was a part of one recently talking about breathing. It just went on and on and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And people have very strong feelings about it. That was actually about whether you leave the breaths in or not, or what level of breath you leave in. I'm very much in favor of leaving breaths in, but having them under control. As an actor, you have breath control. Let me step back a little bit, just historically. Historically, going back, talk about retakes and stuff like that in books. There are a lot of books out there that I recorded 20 years ago. And I know for a fact, because I had a Twitter encounter with somebody recently who mentioned this. So they didn't spoil it, but they're there. And the publisher I worked with, I alerted them to it, and they're going back. But again, it's sort of cost and so on to go back over a book that they should have got right in the first place. Because, you know, I used to, and most of us here, record for a publisher who will then take the files that we've done, and they will proof them, listen through them, for not just that the words are correct, matching the book, but also for the sounds in the background, the doors closing or the whatever retakes and so on, making sure that's called quality control. They'll make sure that the recording is perfect. Quality control and proofing have improved tremendously over the last 20 years, especially for the major publishers. They're doing a wonderful job. Some were very good to begin with. Some got better in the last couple of decades. What happened a few years ago is one particular publisher came into the industry, unloaded boatloads of books on the public, or wanted these recorded. There weren't enough good narrators. I'm including us here in that. There weren't enough, to do all these books. And a lot of people got brought into the industry who, to be honest, were not up to snuff. And that's where a lot of the bad breath, bad pacing, bad whatever was brought in. What this publisher was also has enabled is a sort of a self-publishing format, which leaves the narrator responsible for the proofing and QCing, either by doing it themselves or buying in an engineer, which of course costs money. So a lot of people doing it themselves, not really doing it very well. Now, what has happened in the last few years, the cream has risen to the top. There are a lot of very good narrators came out of that. But there's also still that material is still out there, including my books from 20 years ago that have retakes in them. So people picking up an audiobook today, it may not be aware that this was done years ago, and therefore the problem is a historical one. They may not be aware it's from a few years ago when there were a lot of people who weren't very good. So, you know, I'm getting, you can tell I'm getting excited about this. This is why I got stuck into the voicing.
Yes.
It's breathe. But it's, to me, the
but
breath,
the breath
thing,
works.
To me, the breath thing is a crucial part. And what started one particular thread that I got involved in was that somebody said, I use software to remove the breaths or something like that. You know, it's this idea that it doesn't matter what you do, it can be taken care of in post-production with software or somebody else listening to it. When, as narrators, we bear the responsibility. Basically, we should get it as right as we can at the beginning. And I think, I can't remember who said that, we do bear responsibility when we say sorry for the mistakes that have appeared in our books. But that said, I think, as we move forward, things are getting better. And I'm hoping, but I'm getting muddled up here. I should just say that, people should understand that there's still a lot of books out there that were done in years past. And as time goes on, a good publisher will go back and re-look at those books. A lot of the other ones that come from this other publisher, they're out there, and what can we say but sorry.
Well, and unfortunately, I think with the newbies who are coming in, they haven't listened to a lot of audiobooks. They haven't studied it, so they don't know what mistakes to avoid. Some people think that narrating an audiobook is you're just reading it, but it's really a performance. Mm. And there's so much that goes into it that people don't even consider, that they don't know how distracting those things can be, and maybe they don't take it out. So that's a part of an issue.
You read books for a living? Yeah.
Or I have a great voice, and I should read I read to my kids, so I hear
like
that a lot.
Books.
Yeah.
This is Karen. I think it's to sort of echo what Simon was saying. It's important to remember that editing is a craft, or maybe even an art as well. Knowing what to take out, where to tighten. A pause, where to leave a pause. All those things really affect the rhythm of the listen. And I have gotten to the point where I'm not quite sure who's editing some of my books and how much experience that person has, because so much volume is happening and so many new people are coming into the industry, so that I'm kind of a control freak. So as I go and I'm punching in, as Tanya was describing, I try to deliver a product that I wouldn't mind going out as it is, that I have the pauses that the length that I want them to be. I Absolutely. Leave in yeah. the breaths that mean something, that mean, oh, a person has an idea. So they have an intake of breath, and that, or they're panting or they're emotional. Those breaths mean something to the story, as opposed to when I just ran out of breath because it was a really long sentence. And I just have gotten to the point where I control it as much as possible, and I just hope they don't change it too much.
I learned that the hard way. I had an agreement with one publisher that I would just record, and if I made a mistake, I would pause for a few seconds and then continue, and they would do all the editing afterwards. And I had a kid's book where I had a very difficult name to say, and this was vexing me quite a bit. And I made several attempts at this name pretty much every time it came up, and in a few of them I made some salty editorializations on my own work. And
oh, no.
Lo and behold, in the audio file review, it mentioned the fact that I used language inappropriate to the to the listening audience, and everybody's remaining nameless on this one. But yeah, but that book I believe is still actually, I think that was so bad that was such an egregious.
You could get arrested
mistake.
For that.
Yeah, I think they had to pull the book and re-edit it. But, you know, they left every single take in, including some of them where certain words were used. So now I agree with Karen, and I've become a little bit more of a control freak, and I generally don't let anything leave here until it's at least not going to embarrass me when it hits the market. So, yeah. So, but like Simon said, we are getting better. And that was about 10 years ago. So
there was another part of that question I wanted to address, too, about a fix that's very obvious. So after quality control, we'll get a list of fixes back from the publisher. It can be within a couple of days, which is great, or it can be up to a month. And you get these fixes. And if it doesn't come with a sound file, you sometimes... your voice can change if you have a cold, if it's a different time of day, if your levels have changed at all. So if you don't have something to mimic, it can be really difficult to go through all of your sound files looking and finding that one little phrase that was off. So you do your best, but sometimes it doesn't match up. And that's also unfortunate.
Right. A lot of times you can be somewhere else too. I've had to do fixes on a different setup than what I actually recorded the book on.
I think the responsibility here is with the publisher who's sending, the engineer who's sending the corrections to tell you that that's the case. I think it's really important because it really does make a huge difference. And I know what this, the people who complained about this are talking about, because it is horrendous when you hear a voice suddenly drop out into some other sort of, tone or something, and it's bad. And I always, when I send corrections back, and hopefully either I had a voice match or I've gone back to my files or I've tried to remember what it was. Most of the time I can have an example, but we'll always say, let me know if any of these don't match and I'll redo them.
Absolutely.
I know that I listened to a book this last summer. I'm a Civil War, I like to think I know things about it. And I listened to a 125-hour Civil War book, and it was all nonfiction, and I loved it. But I was so forgiving because, of course, it's excellently narrated. But every one of those edits would just it would drop out, and it would be a completely different background, and it would come in. But I understood by looking at the date that it was okay, probably for those years, that it was fine, and therefore I didn't let it bother me. But if I heard that in a newly released book, oh my goodness, I would not be happy. And we are, once again, we're not naming publishers here or anything like that, but we still do hear exactly what I described in this question. We still hear it today in new books. So they are out there. They are happening. And our hope is to provide some sort of way to say, wait a minute, authors, first of all, you can wisely choose a narrator, just explore some things. And then the narrators, I think some don't have a clue of, about what it takes. And I don't want to get into a lot of negativity here. But
Name them. I want to hear names.
Let's get some drama.
I mean, we actually, for the first time the last 6 months, we have added a production grade to some of our reviews. Usually we do content grade and we do narration grade this is where we go. Well, this was probably in someone's home studio. So who really did the production? Well, we don't know and we're not going to ask, but still we have felt, when there's just all of these things happening, you cannot keep your mind on the story. You just can't, because you're constantly being snapped out of it with these other things. So
it shouldn't get to production with that sound quality. And I've heard these books that have gotten through the process. There should never be a buzzing. A really good quality recording should sound like someone is almost speaking in your ear, speaking right to you, and it's really clear. There shouldn't be any buzzing. There shouldn't be anything that's distracting like that. That's a production issue.
And I think, Vicki, you and your listeners have the power here. Books can be returned and comments can be made. And hopefully, if enough of that happens, then those books get pulled.
I think that's an important point. The comments are looked at by every publisher and narrator, not just Patrick and myself trolling for compliments. I just gotta say, we spend hours on end by ourselves in these little booths. So I'm very forgiving about the fact that I seek any sort of little recommendation or acknowledgement. I guess there is an actual world outside of this little 4x5 booth. But those are, and to empower the listeners, those comments, everybody looks at them. If they say they don't, they're just being modest. Everybody looks at them, and especially publishers pay attention to that.
Yeah, and if you don't highlight them, how's anybody going to know? I'm really glad to hear that you have a production credit on there, because I'm mortified if I find I work for somebody and what something different happens between what left me here and what goes out. But also, if I have been careless, if for some reason my work process after so many years has got lazy and something's getting out there, I need to know. And if nobody's remarking on that, nobody's mentioning it because they think I'm too sensitive or something or whatever, then it doesn't do anybody any good.
It's also important, like with the comment thing, to feel empowered to leave those negative comments. But we do like the positive ones, too, because I think people it's really easy to have that that anger and write something that's really, I hate the narrator, I hate everything about it. But it's also empowering for the listener to tell people what is working. So that lets us know about that, too.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And we care about our work. I mean, we really do care about our work. At least most of us do it. The ones that do this for a living. I mean, this is what we do. And I want to know if it's not right. You know, I don't want to find out that it's not right. Through somebody who just writes this horrible thing that, oh God, his work is always subpar. I want to know, you know, I need the feedback. And if something is wrong, I want to fix it.
Do you get that all the time, Patrick? Your work is
I've
subpar.
Never gotten that, but I can imagine it would be horrible. Yeah.
It's because you're too sensitive. We don't want to hurt your feelings.
Thank God.
Oh, but
I guess he's Luke Daniels all the time.
But it's true. We're not a live theater, so we don't have the end of the night of the audience throwing tomatoes to say we suck or standing up and giving us a standing ovation. We don't have that. So we do look for, how are we making the impact? What can we do to change? How can we grow as an artist? Because we don't, you know, we may read a review and those are really helpful. But the actual common Joe the plumber, those are the ones that you're actually, you know, spending 8 hours in their head, as well as the reviewer. But it's nice to hear from them. It's nice to hear. We love you out there, listeners. We really do.
We're very needy.
So much. It would creep you out. We love you.
I'm gonna share again. I'm sorry. I have to. The other day, I was on a customer service call for my credit card, and the person was very helpful in down in Florida, and he resolved my issue and everything. And at the end, he went, "Can I get personal for a moment?" And I was thinking, "Oh my God! All right, whatever." But he goes, I'm a huge audiobook fan, and I just had to say that I knew who you were right off the bat. It's made my day. I was like, oh God, I almost cried.
So
it just goes with that whole thing. But yeah, it just random Joe guy who happens to listen to them, you know, and it just every now and then you get one of those and it kind of counterbalances the guy who, you know, has a vendetta and he's got a keyboard and he's on Amazon. But anyway, yeah, I'm done.
So I have our last question, and I'm going to start it with Karen. And once again, it is on this same topic, and I'm going to repeat a little bit of what we have just said. This has to do with the inexperienced narrator. With a large influx of self-published audiobooks, we also discovered a large number of substandard performances. When we see that an eagerly anticipated book is to be performed by an unknown narrator, we now assume that the chances of a poor narration are significant. What advice do you have for the inexperienced or untrained narrator? Where can they start?
Well, there's a lot of things. Again, as Tanya said about a previous question, there's a lot of things to unpack here. But to me, from my experience, excuse me, both as a narrator, but also directing new narrators, having a theater background and a theater acting training background is really the best foundation. Part of that includes vocal training, usually years of it. And I don't know if you could survive doing this full time without that. In other acting fields, I think especially on camera, you can get by with just having an interesting personality or maybe in some other voiceover fields, an ability just to do fun character voices. But this works. It requires the training to be able to connect your thought, your voice, your emotions to the author's words, then to the audience, and to maintain that connection, as well as take the listener on the journey with you, and to do it consistently every day, in every moment, in every word of the book. And that requires training. That requires the ability to count on your instrument to be there for you and to deliver. Another thing, specifically for audiobooks, I think one of the best things to do is listen to a lot of audiobooks. Find what you like. There's so many different styles. I think you can't assume that you're necessarily going to be narrating the kind of books that you personally like to read. So you have to listen to a variety of genres and try to figure out where your voice and your skills, like are you really good with accents? Are you not? Where those things fit in? There's a few things that if you do have a theater background that might help you know whether this is something you're even potentially good at. When I was directing and I often worked with new narrators, oftentimes someone would come in and start and I just knew they got it. They just had the sensibility. They were a reader. They were a storyteller. They had all the qualities. There were certain little skills they could develop, things that they could get better at, but there were also other people who came in who probably were incredible actors, maybe even great commercial voiceover actor, but who just didn't get it. And a lot of those people come from, as well as a theater background, the people who get it are also writers. Sometimes they're people who are good at cold readings, meaning they can just look at the word and be able to tell that story without having to study too much. Some things you can do to develop those skills, I think, are to get involved with a play reading group for writers and offer to read plays for them, as well as read the stage directions. And I think that there are also a lot of opportunities these days all over the country for actors to actually study specifically audiobook narration. However, the caution would be that, as in any growing industry, there's going to be people popping up teaching that actually don't have a background that's going to help you. So I would say do your homework, figure out what is this teacher's background and where are their students working? Are they working? Are they only working in the self-publishing part of the industry, or are they actually working for major publishers that will pay a living wage? All these things add up. But I think it's also, you know, a lot of self-awareness is involved, and it may involve in your first books, if you don't have a director, hiring somebody to at least direct you through a few chapters so that you've got someone who knows what they're doing guiding you.
Well, it used to be the barriers to entry were much higher than they are now. You know, for me, I spent 8 years recording for the blind. I wasn't being paid. I mean, I had to be reasonably good to get invited in, but they weren't paying me. So, you know, I think there wasn't that high a barrier for me to get in there. But it took me 8 years. And when I came over here, I was ready, came over to the States in 92. I was ready to enter the commercial world. That's after 8 years. Nowadays, people are expecting, because the microphones are cheap, the equipment is cheap, and there are people out there saying, you can earn money in audiobooks with just a $50 microphone and a cheap laptop. So there's so many people out there putting stuff out through the various sources, publishers and so on, that will enable you to put stuff out, and it appears on the shelf alongside the stuff like Patrick or Luke or me or the Karen do. And it's very difficult for the audience to know whether these new voices are any good. Some of them probably are, but there are no barriers to entry now. It's very difficult. So it does behoove the newcomer to invest a little time. And people don't want to do that because that costs money and time. They want to be there now. I'm saying this stuff and obviously don't really have an answer to it other than, you know, buyer beware in a sense. It's hard to point you in the right direction short of going to the experienced narrators.
I think just real quick, I want to throw in that I think it's an interesting point you bring up because it's a new, relatively new and super fast growing market, there is a responsibility to keep the level of the product at a high enough rate so that it has a longevity. If it does get saturated by a lot of people doing things that start to bring it down and weigh it down so that new listeners start listening and they happen to grab somebody who's inexperienced as their first listen and they go, oh, that sucks. I hate audiobooks. So there's a consequence to that that I think is important in this emerging market that we have to be aware of. And I think there's a lot of that I see behind the scenes with the narrating professionals who kind of reach out and help other new ones to give them information, because if we lift each other up, if everybody gets better at it, then it just will only keep the industry expanding, which thus gives us more jobs, and then we can take our vacations and do, you know, put the kids through school. But I think it's important that we all take an interest in raising the lowest common denominator.
This is Renee. I think that not a week goes by, not one, where I don't receive an email or a phone call, either from somebody directly or a friend of a friend who wants to get into this business, because it is growing so fast and there seem to be so many opportunities. I think what new narrators don't realize, and Simon began to touch on it, is the true investment and expense to becoming a narrator. I mean, it used to be that you could go give it a try, if you will, at a publisher's recording studio. And I know that New York continues, people have the opportunity to record at publishers and professional recording studios still. But for the most part, I would say that if that the trend of the industry is to go to narrators who can self-direct, but also have a room or an area or has created a recording studio in which the sound quality is second to none, which rivals the professional recording studios, that you do have to purchase a microphone that's right for you. And sometimes you have to do trial and error and purchase two or three $700 or $800 microphones. You know, people don't realize the expense of the equipment that we all have invested in. And that includes voice processors and computers and backup drives and soundproofing and
software.
Software. And I think people can be really talented, but when you start to list and itemize, oh yeah, and if you live in, you know, Alaska and you want to record with some of these main publishers, you're going to have to figure out how to have a recording studio on your own. And then not only that, but you have to learn how to run the software, typically, unless you're going to find and bring in an engineer. And that's just a tiny portion of it prior to figuring out how to prep a script and all of those other things. So it's a wonderful industry. And it's, I feel so, so fortunate to have stumbled into it, if you will, you know, 9+ years ago. But it's been a lot of trial and error along the way and a huge expense. And I'm sure all of you on the call can talk about what it's like to have a studio in your home and, you know, the hours that you have to record to work around the lawnmower and that sort of thing.
Well, she touches on something there that I wanted to get into is a lot of people coming in just don't understand that what we do is a lot of work, you know, above the expense and everything. It's a lot of work to do it correctly. So, you know, once a week when I get those calls or emails from people who are trying to get in, who want to know, well, what do I have to do? The first thing I tell them is to take a tape recorder or some recording device and a book and lock yourself in a room for an hour and just read it out loud into this recording device. Then take the next hour and just listen to yourself. And if you get through that, then call me back and we'll talk.
That's really smart.
And then do it smart.
The practicalities.
I lose 99% of them because it's hard. You know, it's for a lot of people. I personally love it, but you know, a lot of people just, you know, the idea of sitting for 8 hours in a studio just reading into a microphone by yourself is not appealing to anybody, but they don't think about that. They think, well, you know, like we've said before, I read stories to my kids or, you know, hey, gee, this would be something great to do now that I'm retiring. It takes a lot of energy and it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of effort. And I'm usually willing to, you know, people say, aren't you worried about people taking your job if you help them and stuff like that? And I say no, because I'll tell them exactly what they need to do, and 99% of them won't do it because it's just too much work, yeah. You know, and this is an industry that you really have to love what you do.
Yeah. I mean, and Patrick, what you say is so right. I mean, I've had the good fortune of doing theater and on camera and commercials and cartoons and video games and really been able to have a lot of fun in a lot of different areas in the entertainment business. But without a doubt, audiobooks are the hardest work I have done in the entertainment business. And I'm not saying it's the hardest work in all of entertainment, but it's the hardest I've done, the most work I've ever done. And what people also don't realize is that when we record an 8-hour day, particularly if you use an engineer, you know, you're on the clock, you're paying somebody else. So you're very, very efficient with your time. And you do not, in that 8-hour day, you start recording at 8 a.m. I take a break an hour and a half. I should take more breaks, but I take a break after an hour and a half. So between 9:30 and 10, I take a 15 to 20 minute break, and I take a 1 hour break at noon, and I take another break at 3. So I have an hour and a half to 2 hour breaks in that from eight in the morning till 5:30 at night. And in that time, you don't want to make a phone call because you've just been talking for, you know, 8 hours. So there's no phone calls. Your brain has been on for an hour and a half straight. You can't answer an email. So there's nothing that happens between, you don't get phone calls. You don't make, it's almost, there's a little bit of a jail, incarceration element to it, but you don't make phone calls. You don't answer emails. And then you come home and you don't want to talk to anybody. You don't, you just need a glass of wine and give me an hour and then we'll talk about dinner. And you know, when you do this week upon week, mail piles up at home, grocery shopping doesn't get done. I mean, I'm making it sound, you know, but really that is the reality of this world. And, you know, so if you can get through all that and you still love narration, then come on. Let's go.
Aaron Patrick mentioned the self-test, but it was a one-hour self-test. And I know our colleagues, Hilary Huber, and I think Sean Allen Pratt as well, recommends not just sitting on the end of your bed reading it to yourself for 1 hour, but do that for an hour, take a break, do it for another hour, take a break, do it for another hour. Do that 5 days a week for the next 2 weeks, then come back and tell me you want to do audiobooks. A little bigger than the 1 hour, but that's what, you know, man, that's the test.
Wow, geez, I didn't realize I was so easy on
you. Yes, you are.
A pushover, Patrick.
Wow.
So let's say we have a narrator that comes to us, not that they would, but let's say they come and they say, well, you talk about we need all this training. Where do we find that? If we get a director, where do we find a director? What is our first step?
Well, it's a good question. This is Luke. I think that your first step is doing it yourself. I think that the training is important. Karen said about the voice training, just the actual physical instrument of being able to maintain for that long. But you're going to be your own boss. Like we've pointed out, most people are going to get their jobs working from home. The big studio setup is going, you know, the way of the dinosaur, but it's still incredibly valuable as a learning tool. So if you don't have that, if you live in Iowa and or in Michigan, where I live, and you don't have a lot of opportunities for that, although I do, if you know the industry, but hypothetically speaking, if you don't have that, then you do the work yourself. You develop the discipline yourself. You listen to audiobooks, like was pointed out. You listen to yourself reading. You read. That is the number one thing, reading. Reading is the one thing that makes us, you know, stave off senility and be smarter. And it is the easiest way to develop yourself is to continue to read. Read aloud. So you're going to be your own boss. You're going to be the one that says, get up at 8 and go do this and take a break. You've got to be that taskmaster. Simon, sounds like you're a pretty hardcore taskmaster. But it's, you have to be successful in this. You have to be willing to do that. So if you're, you go ahead. Sorry.
Oh,
go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to piggyback on that. There is some pragmatic advice about you can also go to each audio publisher's website and see what they want from narrators. And usually that's a demo. So you'll have to record a demo. And you can also join the APA, the Audio Publisher Association, which will give lots of new information to new narrators. Did you hear that? Because there's a weird echo.
Yeah, I didn't get the end of it. I didn't get new narrators, which I'm sure is what you said.
You said yeah. An area on the APA website for new narrators?
Yeah, that you can join the APA or at least research that. And there's a lot of resources through there, too.
Yeah, and Tanya, that's the truth, too, because a lot of times I will see in the APA newsletter that, you know, somebody like, I think most recently was Paul Rubin. He gave some great classes. Is that right? I think it was
yes.
Paul.
Yeah.
And then, one of the good ones. Yeah. Very
right.
Good.
And also, I have to tell you, you know, I know out here in Los Angeles, Pat Fraley holds classes in which Scott Brick will teach, and they'll have other really great audiobook narrators teach those classes. And I've known several people from his classes. And it's just a great way to see if you can read by getting behind that mic in the studio. And you can sometimes come out with a demo reel because they record all your samples. But there have been several narrators who've come out of Pat's classes who have started working and been very successful. And he travels mm-hmm. around the United States, if I'm not mistaken. So
yeah.
Pat mm-hmm. Fraley is a great resource for teaching. And I also think there's ways to reach out to other narrators and ask, you know, just say,
yes,
where's a good place, as opposed to how do I get started in the industry? It feels a lot better if somebody comes, when they come to me, they go, look, I just want to take a class. I want to see if this thing is something I can roll with. And if they go take the class and then they come back to me, I'm much more likely to invest a little bit more time and information in their next steps. So mm-hmm.
I would say nothing beats experience. And back in the day, and I started with reading books for the blind, there are still places out there that will allow you to come in and audition for them. And you don't have to be of a professional narrator level of you know, 10, 20 years experience. You can be a relative beginner, but you'll have some idea. And I don't know, I ask this question of all of you, does LibriVox still exist? Because that was somewhere you could volunteer to record a chapter of a book and it would go online and you get feedback from people. And it was unpaid and the standard was not very high. And I don't think it still exists. I doubt that it's got particularly much better, but it's a chance for you to get out there, because it's one thing to go into class and narrate for 2 minutes, 3 minutes or whatever. And another thing to sit there for 45 minutes or an hour, as we've said, completely different. But if you can do that and you get a good response, then I think you're on a good footing to then approach and send demos to publishers and so on.
Great advice.
I don't know LibriVox. I don't think it does exist, does it? Has anybody else
I've heard of it, but I haven't heard it. I haven't heard it being recent. Yeah.
No, I haven't. I can look it up right now.
Ah, but there's a lot of training, too. I don't know the quality of it, but I know that if you are kind of stuck in the outlying lands where you can't have access to a major studio, you can do things through Skype and online, and there's other resources if you're kind of dedicated and diligent about it. And I think that's the key common denominator to all of this. If you're dedicated and diligent to wanting to do it, then you'll end up doing it. But if you're kind of half-assing it, it's not going to happen. It's just too much.
Yeah. LibriVox does exist. Free public domain audiobooks read by volunteers from around the world.
That's fantastic. Neat. What a great resource.
LIBRIVOX. LIBRIVOX.org.
Great.
We should all go on it and just do a chapter.
Volunteer.
See what they say.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't know if I want to. Also, yeah, there a lot of very, very good narrators, a lot of terrific narrators, to get back to what Luke was saying, offer audiobook classes on Skype. So, but be very careful when you go looking, and make sure that the person that you're taking these classes from know what they're doing.
Yeah, be careful of those people who say there's lots of money to be made in audiobooks.
Do a little research, you know, check out the person you're paying or taking the class from. It's not that hard to find
there's
out.
Not that much money to be made.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to spend a lot of hours in the booth
to make a living wage. It's a full-time job to make money, you know, in this
right.
business.
Yeah, full-time. Yeah, that's right. Tell them that so that they don't come in and spoil our little thing here. Okay. Yeah. I gotta go. My yacht's double parked.
Yeah, your nose is growing right now.
I judge you one thing. We don't, most of us, I know people who are listening think about this, and I'm sorry to talk about the dirty side of the business, money, but we don't make residuals. In very few occasions do we make residuals on what we sell. This isn't like a TV show or a movie where we signed a contract and we get money every time it's shown on cable or whatever. No, we don't do that. I just thought I'd get that in there.
Yeah, you have to work so much every month to make your monthly nut, you know, and that
That's right.
So,
yeah.
It's truly a labor of love, too, because like was pointed out before, you're in this dark room working and you're going through horrible things sometimes, especially if you're narrating, you know, any number of things. But by the end of the day, you come upstairs and the kids are running around. And you're like, well, I just decimated an alien population and everybody died and I lost my child in my arms. And, you know, what did you do today? And it's like, you know, my wife's in social work. So she's like, I did that, but it was real. And I'm like, oh,
yeah, exactly.
I got nothing.
I'll make dinner. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that one thing that sometimes people forget because they're going off of, oh, well, I have a great voice, so people want to listen to me for a long time so I can do this. But I think besides having the theater background and the acting training, you have to really love to read. And I think a lot of people forget about that when they're thinking about going into audiobooks. You really have to love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it is the greatest job, though, as an actor. You don't have to memorize any lines. You get to play all the parts, and you can wear whatever the hell you want. So
that's
it's,
right.
I
love
it.
You don't get typecast.
Here, here.
And Luke, I think, was it you that was just saying, I come upstairs and talk to the family? And
right.
It is amazing how emotional a day can be, or a week, or 3 weeks, and a month, and how that does impact our... I won't speak for all of you, but... I just remember once, several years ago, I had four very emotional and heartfelt memoirs. And usually if somebody's writing a memoir, there's something quite big to say. And at the end of the day, I would come out and be with John, and he goes, look at this new surfing video I have on this big screen TV. And there's a little boy who went, that's my dad. And I go, let's turn it off. I finally told him, can't send anything more. I cannot do something like this again for another 3 months or 2 months, or give me a break, or really hard. You know. And it does become a part of who you are.
I was going to say how much I've enjoyed this conversation and until we got into the emotional part at the end there. But I just want to thank Audio Girls for inviting me to be a part of this, because we sit in our 6x4 cubicle. Some of us are lucky enough to maybe have one guy behind the screen to work with or whatever, but a lot of us sit alone. And it's just great to interact with my colleagues. I just want to say I admire you all, guys. This is great.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us. Thank you. We love you being with us.
We love
you so much.
Thank you.
I love your ears. Thank you to Audio Gals.
I want to end by giving some special thanks. First of all, to Karen White for helping me organize today's forum and brainstorming with the gals on discussion topics. This is the fourth time Karen has assisted me with one of these narrator forums. And I can't forget Brenda, our technical gal, who is responsible for recording and editing our forum. Thanks, Brenda, for so effectively taking care of our back room, a responsibility that takes a great deal of time. Listeners, all of our narrators today will be stopping by Audio Gals to answer any questions you may have. Thanks again for joining us.
Vicky.
Thank you. That was fun.
That was fun. I hope I enjoyed it. I did.
Brenda better make sure to take out all the retakes and the breaths. Okay?
That's right.
No breaths. Can you imagine just one long thing? No breaths.